But what happens right now is that these massive constitutional questions, which have a lot of consequences for people's lives, basically end up getting decided based on when someone randomly dies. And it's not a good way to run a country, in my opinion.
Welcome to another episode of America Explained, the podcast that brings the important voices and perspectives shaping American politics, foreign policy, and culture to an international audience.
Today we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court, which has had an increasingly controversial position in American politics in recent years. As you probably remember, Donald Trump appointed three justices to the court. That really changed the ideological composition of the court and made it much more right-wing than it had been. And in each of these cases, there were a lot of questions around both the process by which Trump appointed those justices, but also the pretty extreme viewpoints that they held. And this really worried a lot of people.
Yeah, so there were a lot of fears amongst Democrats and even people around the world that this would lead to a rolling back of a lot of progressive reforms that we've had in recent decades. So everything from voting rights to abortion and women's rights, same-sex marriage, environmental protections, and fears that the court would become a partisan tool of the president rather than an independent judicial body. And so the point I want to make in today's episode is not that the court hasn't ruled along clear partisan lines on certain cases, but more so that there's been some surprising rulings that suggest a bit more nuance when discussing the current Supreme Court.
Right, yeah. So I think that the argument isn't that the Supreme Court has not done some stuff that's fulfilled these liberal fears. So, you know, we've talked on this podcast before about the overturning of Roe v. Wade. That was the decision that was called the Dobbs decision. That was obviously a really big deal. There was also a big ruling on affirmative action, which basically said that universities cannot use race as a category for in admissions. So it basically means that universities can't give advantages in admissions to disadvantaged racial groups. So these decisions were very much against what liberals hoped for, but the court has also done a whole lot of different stuff. And some of these cases are not so easy to pass through this partisan lens. And there are also cases that you're less likely to have heard about because they don't really make the news in the same way. I think you can have different opinions about why the court does some things that do not seem to hew to the ideology that you expect from it. I think that historically, Supreme Court majorities have been very careful to try to maintain the legitimacy of the court by not moving too far or too fast in a particular direction. But it's also the case that justices just have lots of opinions which diverge from the particular interest or pressure groups within the parties that appointed them. So they end up ruling in ways that you might not expect. And these are the cases that we really want to dive into today.
Yeah, so in this episode today, we're going to go through some of these less well-known cases and explain what happened and why.
So the first one that I want to talk about is one called Moore v. Harper. Before this case was decided last summer, it was probably the one that liberals were freaking out about the most because it seemed to have really, really major implications for the future of democracy in America. And what this case was basically about was who gets to make the rules which govern how elections operate in the United States. The strange thing about U.S. federal elections for president and Congress is that they're actually administered by the states. The U.S. doesn't have some kind of federal election administration, but instead each individual state runs elections and then basically reports the results upwards to the federal government. Moore v. Harper was a case about how elections were going to be run within the state. And what it was basically about was, do state legislatures, so, you know, like the House of Representatives of Ohio and California, these state lawmaking bodies, do they get the final say over how elections should be run? Or can state courts overrule them and force them to comply with, for instance, the US Constitution or the state constitution? Now, this seems really esoteric, but it's actually really important because if you think about what it basically means, are you going to have elections be run in accordance with state constitutions and the US Constitution? Or are you going to let a bunch of elected politicians decide what to do without any checks or balances on their behavior whatsoever? And in Moore v. Harper, some people were making that claim. They were advancing something called the independent state legislature. I always struggle with that word, legislature theory, which says that indeed state legislatures do have carte blanche to run elections however they want without even having courts oversee. Now, this would be really radical because I can't think of any other situation in American law where it is the case that courts cannot provide a check and a balance and oppose what lawmakers do. Now, this case was really important. It had its origins in a gerrymandering case that came out of North Carolina. But what made it so important and loom so large in these kind of liberal nightmare scenarios about the end of democracy in America was that during the 2020 presidential election, you had some Republican state legislatures looking like they wanted to basically illegitimately throw the election to Donald Trump, even though Joe Biden had won the most votes in their states. So a lot of people were really worried that if the court embraced this independent state legislature theory, then in the 2024 election, you could basically, you know, have it happen that Joe Biden, say, would win Michigan, but then a Republican state legislature would say, actually, we decide that Donald Trump won Michigan. So, you know, that's what's going to happen. And this would basically, I mean, if that happened, then that's really, really bad for the future of American democracy. But even if such nightmare scenarios hadn't happened, then it would also have been the case that, for instance, a lot of state constitutional protections against things like gerrymandering, against things like depriving people of their voting rights would have been destroyed. So, you know, in theory, like the legislature of Georgia could just have said, we rule that African Americans cannot vote. And according to the independent state legislature theory, there would have been nothing that any court could have done about that. Now, in the end, the Supreme Court ruled against this idea pretty resoundingly. They rejected it. And in a sense, this wasn't particularly surprising because this theory had been rejected repeatedly by the Supreme Court in other cases over the last century. But on the other hand, this was kind of, I think, also a warning sign about the future, because even though this theory is completely crackpot, I mean, it's hard to kind of overstate how novel and weird this idea is, it still got the support of three of the current justices on the Supreme Court, even though it was such a radical case. So that kind of tells you that if the court moves even further to the right, that some really wacky and bad things could start happening. But we're not quite at the point yet where they're ready to embrace something as crazy as the independent state legislature theory.
Yeah, so the next case that I wanted to talk about was the upholding of the Indian Child Welfare Act. And this case was called Holland v. Brackeen, and it was decided in June of 2023. And so to understand this case, you have to understand a bit of the history of the way that Native American children have been treated in the United States. So for a long time, there was a history of forced assimilation and adoption with non-Native families. And at the time the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in the 1970s, around 25 to 35% of Native children had been removed from their families. And so this act was created to protect Native children from being placed in non-Native families. And so if there were adoption cases, they would, you know, first try to be placed with extended family and then with other Native families and only then with non-Native families. And so another important aspect of this is that in the U.S., Native American tribes have a lot of sovereignty over their reservations and tribal lands, and also that tribal courts have full jurisdiction over custody cases on their lands, as well as concurrent jurisdiction with state courts on cases that don't take place on tribal land. And so this case involved a non-Native couple in Texas, the Brackeens, and they had adopted a boy with a Navajo mother and a Cherokee father back in 2018. And they had a bit of a legal battle, but eventually the adoption was approved by Navajo courts. But then later in 2018, the boy's biological mother gave birth to a daughter, and the Brackeens sought to adopt her as well so they could keep the two siblings together. And even though the girl was not born on a reservation, the Navajo court still had some jurisdiction, and they gave custody to a great aunt who also had custody of some other siblings and cousins. But then a judge in Texas gave the Brackeens custody, but required the girl to have visits with her family on the reservation. And so both parties appealed this, which is how it made its way to the Supreme Court. And the Brackeens not only challenged the ruling, but they also wanted to completely strike down ICWA, the Child Welfare Act. And so this case had the potential to seriously undermine tribal sovereignty, not just in, you know, adoption custody cases, but in other areas, and set a lot of new legal precedents. But it didn't. So what exactly happened? So in the end, the ruling upheld ICWA, and only two justices, Thomas and Alito, dissented. And they upheld ICWA, and Neil Gorsuch, in his opinion, also wrote in great detail about the history of U.S. oppression of Native Americans and infringement on tribal sovereignty. And I think, you know, just as importantly, if this had gone the other way, and if ICWA had been deemed unconstitutional, it could have opened up a Pandora's box of undermining tribal sovereignty on things related to gaming and casinos and fossil fuel resources, which some people might have, you know, heard about more recently with the film Killers of the Flower Moon that came out last year. And something that I find quite interesting about this case is that the Brackeens were represented pro bono by a law firm that also represented corporations like Shell and Chevron, as well as major casino corporations. So it seems as though this case was not just about the adoption, but was also maybe about interests of undermining tribal sovereignty in other areas. But that's not what happened. And we saw all three of Trump's appointee justices siding very strongly with tribal and federal interests and against corporate and state interests, which I think is super fascinating.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about Neil Gorsuch, because he's probably the strongest proponent of tribal rights on the Supreme Court. And I mean, he comes from Colorado, right? So, you know, I think he's like the only Westerner on the Supreme Court. So, you know, he knows a lot about these issues and he's familiar with the tribes.
Yeah, exactly. So it makes sense that he wrote a concurring opinion on this issue as well.
Yeah, and it's an interesting example of how, you know, the Supreme Court justices have opinions that don't necessarily fit with the idea that we have that they're kind of evil geniuses of one ideological side.
Exactly, yeah.
So the next case that I want to talk about is an animal rights case. So this one was called National Pork Producers Council v. Ross, and the court decided it sometime last year. This case has its origins in a California ballot initiative, which voters approved in 2018, called the Prevention of Cruelty to Farm Animals Act. And this was basically, this proposition was basically about what kind of welfare standards do you need to raise farm animals with if you want to sell the products that you get from those animals in the state of California. And it was particularly about veal and pork and eggs. And California said, if you want to sell these products in our state, then you have to apply certain higher animal welfare standards than are typical in American industrial agriculture. Now, I mean, it's just kind of worth saying here that these improved conditions are not actually like that great, because in general, industrial agriculture in the United States allows animals to be kept in much worse conditions than they are, for instance, here in Europe. So, I mean, one thing that I always find really shocking is that in the U.S., there is absolutely zero federal law that governs the welfare of chickens who are raised for meat. You can basically do whatever you want to those chickens under federal law, and there's nothing mandating welfare standards whatsoever. And what California was trying to do here was just basically to introduce pretty minimal standards. So they said that when you're raising chickens for eggs, those chickens have to be able to spread their wings. And when you're raising pigs and calves for pork and veal, they have to have enough space just to be able to stand up and to turn around. And it also banned these things called battery cages and gestation crates. Now, it's worth just kind of pausing for a minute to talk about what those things are. And I try not to talk too much about animal rights on this podcast because I'm super aware of the possibility of becoming that like lecturing vegetarian. And I know it's a really divisive subject, but it's also one that I feel really strongly about. And battery cages and gestation crates are just completely awful. They're, you know, hens and pregnant pigs are kept in terrible conditions in the U.S. that they're really prone to like very, very, you know, behavior that's born of the stress that they are kept in. So they're prone to fighting each other a lot. You have loads of cases of hens eating one another. Pregnant pigs fight one another all the time and can kill each other. And the point of battery cages and gestation crates is rather than giving these animals the space that they need to, you know, develop and to express their social practices, it's instead basically to immobilize them so they can't move and they can't harm one another. It's really horrific animal abuse, and it's banned in much of the world, including here in Europe, but it's perfectly legal in most of the US. And in 2018, California voters agreed that they wanted to impose these standards for animal products that were sold in California. But what happened then was that the pork industry saw this as a huge threat to its bottom line, and it sued to try to overturn the law. Now, you see a lot of cases like this where basically, because California is such a huge market, I think it accounts for something like just under 15% of all the pork that's sold in the US is sold in California. It means that whenever California raises the standards of its regulation, it has a huge ripple effect beyond the state. Producers all over the country have to raise their own standards as well, because they need to be able to keep selling their products in California. So what usually happens is that because, you know, those companies then have a choice. Basically, they can either set up completely separate facilities where they raise animals in accordance with the California standards, or they can just raise standards across their whole operation and you know, raise the bar. And that often turns out to be the cheaper thing for them to do, but it's still very expensive for them to provide these better standards. So they sued to try to get rid of this law and stop themselves having to take that hit to their bottom line. And when they did that, so they sued under something called the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Now, the Commerce Clause, and sometimes you hear this described as the Interstate Commerce Clause or the Dormant Commerce Clause. And basically the point of this part of the Constitution is to stop states economically discriminating against one another. So if California tried to put a tariff of 20% on all pork products that came into California from outside the state, that wouldn't be allowed under the Constitution. You have to have a situation of free trade between the states under the Constitution. And so in the past, the way that the Supreme Court has tended to interpret this is to say that if a state imposes a particular requirement and it imposes it on both producers inside the state and producers outside the state, then that is perfectly constitutional and that's basically fine. So if California had said that only pigs raised in Iowa had to meet these requirements, then that would be unconstitutional because that's discrimination against producers in Iowa. But because California applied the same standards also to its own producers, this wasn't a case of trade discrimination, and it was fine. And basically the court just went along with this settled interpretation of the Commerce Clause. They didn't really try to change it. They didn't try to weaken it in any way. And, you know, that was a really good thing. It was also a little bit, you know, this was why this case was a bit surprising, because a lot of liberals were worried that the Supreme Court might try to narrow the scope of the Commerce Clause, because this is also a really important part of making the green transition and dealing with climate change in the US, because California, what it does to pork producers, it also does to the makers of automobile engines. So California has these really strict rules on the emissions that car engines can put out. And that's leading to this ripple effect across the country where most of the big automakers are meeting these California standards. And, you know, that's doing something to help with climate change. So a radical reinterpretation of that clause might have really had an impact for climate change as well as animal welfare. So it was great that the Supreme Court just went with a settled consensus, didn't really try to monkey around with it at all.
Yeah, so I think you can also compare the role that California has in the US to a bit like the Brussels effect that some of our EU listeners might be familiar with, where the EU has some tighter regulations on things. And just because it's easier for companies to apply those, since the EU is such a large economy, they get spread elsewhere. And yeah, California kind of has that role in the US. And so this case seems like it was really just upholding that as well. And, you know, leaving open that, like you mentioned, with emissions and other environmental regulations, that could continue to have a ripple effect in the future.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's just like the EU, and it would have been really bad if California's ability to do that had been weakened some way.
Yeah, definitely. And another aspect of that case that you mentioned is sort of that the Supreme Court, they weren't really ruling very radically. They were just sort of upholding the consensus and like previous rulings. And I think that's something the court does quite often because they know they're the highest court in the nation. And so rulings that they have can have such a large effect. So in the next case that I want to talk about, similarly, they didn't really make a radical ruling, but they just upheld lower courts' rulings. And that was the Allen v. Milligan case, which dealt with Alabama district voting maps. And this was another really surprising one, I think, especially because it dealt with the Voting Rights Act. And previously, the court, including Chief Justice John Roberts, have voted to cut back on a lot of Voting Rights Act provisions. And so people were worried that this court would continue to kind of gut the Voting Rights Act and make it irrelevant. And so just as a reminder, the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965 and signed by President Johnson. And it essentially dealt with these discriminatory voting practices that had been prevalent, especially in the South of the U.S., since the end of the Civil War, where often Black voters were required to take literacy tests or pay poll taxes in order to vote. And this happened at the height of the Civil Rights Movement and involved activists like Martin Luther King Jr. And so in this case, in Allen v. Milligan, after the 2020 census, the state of Alabama planned to create new districts for its 7 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. And despite the fact that 40% of the population of Alabama is Black, only 1 of the 7 districts had a Black majority. And some left-wing groups challenged this voting map on the basis that it violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is a bit complicated and we won't get into it here, but essentially it prohibits voting practices that could discriminate on the basis of race. And a district court, which I should also mention included Trump appointee judges, unanimously found that the voting map did probably violate the Voting Rights Act and ordered the state to create a new map. But the state of Alabama appealed this, and that's how it made its way to the Supreme Court. And the court, surprisingly, agreed with the district court in a 5-4 ruling, so it was quite close, and said that the maps probably did violate the Voting Rights Act. So Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Brett Kavanaugh, were in the majority. So again, it was a very tight ruling, but they didn't, you know, make any drastic rulings, but they just agreed and affirmed that the lower court was probably right. And so they should create a new map. And that yet a few months later, in September of 2023, the state didn't properly enforce the ruling with their new map, and they were again challenged, but the Supreme Court denied giving them time to postpone creating a new map. So essentially, this was a double win for voting rights activists. And here we saw Chief Justice Roberts, who's, you know, a bit of a moderate in the court, as well as Kavanaugh, signing with the liberal justices, which is especially noteworthy, as I mentioned, because Roberts had previously rolled back some provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And I think this was a really important case because it preserved aspects of civil rights legislation that has helped bring protections and equal rights to, you know, all sorts of minority voters, and not just Black voters, but also other voters who might be in language minorities and other minority groups. So it was a really important ruling.
I think one of the things that's really interesting here is the way that the composition of the court has shifted so much that so now Kavanaugh is kind of somewhat in the more moderate position on this court, you know, whereas when he was appointed, he was seen as potentially been really far to the right. But in a few cases, he's proven that he's more moderate than the other conservative justices. So, and there was even this case, Sackett v. EPA. So the EPA is the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the agency of the federal government that enforces environmental regulation. And it's a really big target of conservatives. Like, I would say one of the main goals of a conservative legal movement is to get rid of the EPA. And what they particularly don't like is that they claim that the EPA, by creating regulations, basically is acting in a way that only Congress can act. So they say only Congress can pass laws. And, you know, so the EPA cannot pass regulations that have the force of law because that's unconstitutionally taking on the role of Congress. And if they manage to get this doctrine through the Supreme Court, it would to a great extent destroy the ability of the federal government to regulate the economy and regulate the environment. Now, this particular case, Sackett v. EPA, was a little bit narrower than that. This was particularly about the EPA's ability to enforce the Clean Water Act, in particular wetlands, to basically protect those wetlands from industrial pollutants and degradation. And Kavanaugh actually joined the dissent against this opinion. He joined with the liberals, or I think maybe he wrote his own dissent rather than joining the liberals' dissent, but in any way he dissented from it in a way that was to protect the authority of the EPA. So, you know, again, it's like, not all of these justices are just marching in lockstep to achieve every single goal of the conservative legal movement, right? They are flexible as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, as you said, with Kavanaugh becoming sort of one of the moderates or swing votes, I think that maybe says less about him than it does about how far right the court has shifted in general as well.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And you know, look, like, so the, you know, as a closing thought, I think it's important to say that the message of this episode is not complacency. It's just to try to show that there's a lot of complexity in what the court has been doing over the last few years, and there will likely continue to be so into the future.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in other cases, the court has ruled in these more predictable partisan ways, like you mentioned earlier with Dobbs and affirmative action. And also, given that some of these court rulings have been quite narrow in scope, you know, not really changing that much, I think it's likely that conservative activist groups will continue trying to bring cases to the court to challenge other angles of certain cases if they think, because you can kind of read the logic of the rulings and understand why justices made certain decisions. And maybe if a case was coming from a different angle, they would have ruled differently. And I think that's one of the reasons why after the Dobbs ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade, a lot of conservative doctor and other activist groups challenged the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, about an abortion pill. And that case right now is being heard by the Supreme Court as we speak. And that ruling could either limit or protect access to a very common abortion pill that I think accounts for almost half of abortions in the U.S. And that could even potentially have an impact in states where abortion is legal. So, you know, you're always going to have these groups trying to bring cases to the court, especially when the court is so conservative, because they think that there could be a chance for different precedents to be overturned. And with that abortion pill case right now, it seems as though the court is leaning towards protecting access. Yesterday, in the court's arguments, it seemed as though they were a bit skeptical of why they were even hearing the case. So we'll hear about that later this summer.
Yeah, and there's actually a lot of important cases still to be decided this term. So there's a big gun rights case. There's the case over Trump's criminal liability. So can Trump face trial for things that he did while he was president? And we don't know how the court's going to come out on these things. So their term ends over the summer, and they're going to have a lot of big rulings between now and then. And probably we'll come back on, you know, on the podcast in the future to talk about what happens in the last couple of months of the court's term as well.
Yeah, so I think it's also important to point out that the composition of the court is likely to remain right-wing and perhaps even more so for the foreseeable future. Because in the Supreme Court, justices serve for life, so until they die or decide of their own accord to retire. And there's a few older members now, which means next president might get to fill a seat or two, but a lot of the members are in their 50s or early 60s. So when you look at the likely composition of the Senate in the coming years as well, it's likely that Democrats might really struggle to get liberal justices confirmed as President Obama did.
Yeah, and I think that that point about retiring also brings up this tricky question of when they should retire and should they be pressured to retire? Because, I mean, you know, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg had retired when Obama was president, then, you know, she could have been replaced with a liberal. And right now, Sonia Sotomayor, 69 years old, chance that the Republicans are going to have the White House for the next 8 years, arguably she should retire too and you know, let someone younger take her place. But then, you know, you sound like age discrimination, right? And that's not where I'm coming from, but it's just, you know, there's a lot at stake in that decision.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think, you know, if there was a mandatory retirement age of some sort, that would take the politics out of it, because then you wouldn't have, you know, people feeling pressure to retire or to hold out for a few more years, because it would just be kind of standardized. Yeah, that's a whole other argument.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. And the idea that I really like about this is that I really wish that the retirement of Supreme Court justices was scheduled so that also going into a presidential election, people knew what was at stake, right? I mean, if in 2016, American voters had known that Donald Trump was going to get to appoint 3 Supreme Court justices, that could potentially really change the outcome of that election. But what happens right now is that these massive constitutional questions, which have a lot of consequences for people's lives, basically end up getting decided based on when someone randomly dies. And it's not a good way to run a country, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So we're going to come back in the future and keep you updated on the last few months of the Supreme Court term. If you enjoy America Explained, please tell a friend about the show. That really helps us to grow. Consider checking out our newsletter. You can find a link to that in the show notes, and that comes into your inbox several times a week with updates on U.S. foreign policy, politics, and culture. So thanks again for joining us, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to America Explained, which is brought to you by host Andy Gawthor and researcher, editorial assistant, and sometimes co-host Catherine Wood. If you like America Explained, please consider checking out our free newsletter, which you can find a link to in the show notes. That's all for this episode, and I look forward to speaking to you next time.